Good evening. It is a pleasure to be here this evening with you. Thank you to your planning committee for inviting me to come and... I'm stepping on some wires here, so I need to get situated. Thank you to your planning committee for inviting me to come speak to you this evening and share a little bit about the work that we're doing in Northeast Indiana and also other places across Indiana and Baltimore, Maryland. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Thank you for inviting me again. In 1990, I think it would have been 1992, I became a member of NASW. I was a college student, so how many college students do we have tonight? Oh, wow. So you all are present. Good. I became a member at that time, and after I completed my undergraduate degree at Eastern Mennonite, I got a job, and I had to start paying my loans, and so I couldn't afford membership. And so I saw some faces going, And so... I've not been with NASW for a while. But, however, when I was a member, I bought some books, and I still have these books. And so maybe we'll see if some of you all bought these books when I was a member and see if you all still use these books. I bought a book that's called Church Social Work. Anybody ever see that book? Hey, way to go, rocking, cool. Church Social Work. There was also another one that I've used actually on occasion as I was working with children in Puerto Rico. It's called Encounters with Children. Anybody get that one? Hey, good. We got another fan back there. Mr. Alan Keith Lucas. Is he still living? Oh, okay. After a better life. This is good. And Heart Strangely Warmed. Very good. I was just reading that tonight. It's got scripture passages, and then it gives you sort of a summary of the scripture or of the passage. And then there's Spirit-Led Helping. Wow, we got some people who have still... Do you still have these books and you read them every now and then? Occasionally. Very good. I look through them occasionally too, so it's all good. Throughout the years, I've used those booklets as references to several activities in my community. And so I thank professors at that time who encouraged me to become a member. And so I need to work on that again. So I followed you from a distance, and I count it an honor to stand before you this evening, knowing that there are many others of you out there in the audience that could actually be standing up here. And so I'm very honored that you would invite me to come share. My childhood, in many ways, prepared me for social work. I grew up in a home where my parents were pastors of a Latino Mennonite church and in South Texas. So I grew up in South Texas. I am not Puerto Rican. My wife is the one who has the Puerto Rican. Everybody thinks I'm from Puerto Rico because I got an MSW in Puerto Rico, but no. I'm from South Texas. I grew up in a small town called Robstown. Robstown, Texas, and our mascot at our school was the Cotton Pickers. And so in junior high, we were the Boll Weevils. And then when you got up to high school, you were a part of the Cotton Picker Band because I was a trumpet player. So I didn't bring my trumpet tonight, but that's okay. We'll spare you that noise. Anybody on Facebook? Who has Facebook? Oh, nice. I wrote the other day on Facebook, before I went to work, my kids went off, and I played my trumpet a little bit, you know, just to get the chops and see if there's anything there. It was bad. So I just put on Facebook, you know, played my trumpet, made some noise, you know, and then people can comment on your post, right? Yeah, I see some smiles over here and stuff. Yeah, oh, man, we can see Big Teeth over there. and then... All of my classmates, like there's 15 or 16 of us who really stuck together in high school and band, and they all wrote back, "Go Red!" You know, because we were the red, you know, red and white. So it was wonderful to do that, but I'm going to spare you a trumpet playing tonight. My parents were very active in community, and they welcomed people to my home, into our home. And so I spent many nights on the sofa, and I spent many nights on the floor because we had people passing through. And so they took my bed, and they slept there. And sometimes they stayed a week, 2 months, 3 months, and sometimes they stayed 6 months. And we took care of these people, and my parents took care of them, and we got them jobs, and we moved around. And so those experiences growing up have shaped who I am today. In my community where I grew up, it was a very diverse community. And your title for your conference these next 3 days is Empowering Diverse Communities, Bridging the Social Divide. I spent a lot of time talking to Assembly of God people, Catholics, Protestants, folks who were Baptist, Pentecostal. We were the only Mennonite church in South Texas in that area. So it was a very diverse community. And I realized today that these people that were in their own congregations, it was really about them trying to fill those spiritual needs of their parishioners and their people. And then about a few years later, I graduated, and then I went to Kansas. Anybody from Kansas here? Ooh, Kansas. Where in Kansas? Liberal, sure. Liberal. Well, I went and lived in Newton. You know where Newton is? Yeah, there are a lot of Mennonites there. They all kind of gather together, these Mennonites. I got another story about Mennonites in a little bit. I'll tell you shortly. But here I spent some time doing community survey work. And so I'd go out and talk to people and ask them what their needs were and talked about what they wanted for their lives. And so we coordinated English language classes and we got people moving and so forth. And that was also an experience that impacted me, that made me aware of that I really wanted to be a social worker. I'm a member of the Mennonite Church, USA, and I attend Waterford Mennonite Church in Goshen, Indiana. And I'm a part of a loving faith community that cares for me and my family, and currently just worship there and have a really good time. So there's a group of people who are praying for me right now. They know I'm here with you, and we're all having a great time. And many of my life experiences that I'm going to share today have shaped me and have helped me think about what it is to work with people in positions that they don't have as much power as perhaps I do. The other thing about Mennonites is that I was reading the bio for your second keynote speaker, and that's Dr. Terry Wolfer. And he's an Anabaptist, or he's a Mennonite Anabaptist. And so I'm wondering if your planning committee, when they invited me, they thought, oh, they didn't know I was a Mennonite. And so now you have two Anabaptist speakers. Where are you, Dr. Wolfer? Maybe he stepped out or taken over. Yeah, go red. Okay. That's great. But hopefully it's not a coup or anything here that we're going to... I come to you this evening with a varied life experience that have impacted my life in good ways, but also sometimes in not so good ways. I come to you this evening with my friends and colleagues who are doing extraordinary work in their community at empowering youth, empowering communities, and empowering people who are so excited about being here. I also come to you with much hope and knowing that each one of you is working to bridge that social divide in your communities and empower communities. The title for your conference, which is Empowering Diverse Communities, is one that I found very interesting because the people that I have invited to come with me are doing this very thing. They are working with individuals in community, and it's their experiences that are also important. And so as we think of empowering diverse communities, it's also important that people who are doing this work show us, give us a window as social workers, as Christian social workers, in terms of what our future looks like with these people in community. And with me today are folks from the Latino Youth Collective, and I'll have them stand up, Felipe Vargas and Jair Carvajal, who are here. And they will share briefly of the work that they are doing. Also with me is Carmen DeRusha, who is from Purdue Extension Economic and Community Development. She will also share. And then Belkis Ramirez, who is from the Latino Health Organization. And other groups I'm going to speak about tonight are Operation Foundation out of Ligonier, Elkhart County Works Together in Goshen, Indiana, Ser Group Internacional, which is a group out of Asunción, Paraguay, and Burmese Mental Health Task Force out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Each one of these groups will have an opportunity as we move through the slides. We will get to the slides eventually. And Rebecca, where are you, Rebecca? Rebecca said that I could just take as long as I wanted because y'all started late. So we're going to go as long as we need to go this evening. Great. They're a diverse group of people that are here with me. They are community participatory researchers. They are community development workers, the college students, physicians, principals, managers from Kroger's. They're graphics designers. They're administrative assistants. They're mental health educators. They're residents of the community, and they're immigrants. And most of all, these people are my friends that I've met along the way, and they're people I relate to and I respect and I admire, and that's why I invite them to come here and tell you their story and tell them who they are. Some I know longer than others, and others I've come to know them shortly. What we want to do tonight is look at understanding an empowerment map. And I'll explain that a little bit later. But we want to look at virtues, vocation, and vision. And so hopefully tonight you can leave with a sense of, what is our purpose? What is our direction? Where are we going with working with people in community? And then hear stories of people who are involved in this work of empowering communities, and I've listed them there. Does anybody ever have groans? You ever thought of groans? I groan? Yeah. A lot of the work of empowering diverse communities is about groans, and I'll explain that here. It's a creation groan, and it's a we groan, and it's a spirit groan. And this comes from, his name is Trevor Hudson. He pastors a Methodist church in Benoni, South Africa, who was doing some really interesting work there. The creation groan, and which is part of the map, which I've we'll share later. It's really about what are we doing to assist the global community on the issue of empowering diverse communities. So from the get-go, it's not about us. It's about the global community. What are we doing to think about the global community and empowering that diverse community? So it's not just North America we need to think about. It's the globe. It's people in different places. And so we move away from individualism and versus listening to our friends. We listen to our friends across the globe on how they experience empowerment. So I'm in conversation with people in Africa as they are working at building bridges with indigenous groups in Africa. And I'm in conversation with people in Paraguay that they are trying to figure out how to train leaders, prepare them. Danisa Nolovu, who is from Zimbabwe, who is the Mennonite World Conference president, says, we must rid ourselves from a life of self-interest. Our lives should always seek to find the good in others. We all have a similar song. It's very powerful to hear the song this evening. Grace, salvation, feed the hungry, take action. You're on the right path. But Trevor Hudson says the right path is we need to think about the broader community, which is the global community. Who are they? Do you know them? Are you in relationship with them? That's where we need to go. So God wraps His arms around communities all over the world, not just North America. The We Groans, that's our organization. That's what's driving you. So it would be a really fascinating question to ask your planning committee. Why the title Empowering Diverse Communities, Bridging the Social Divide? What moved you to want to talk and to learn about this? We each have our stories about empowerment. Each one of you comes to this conference with a story of empowerment. And we've experienced sorrow, anger, disillusionment, loss, joy, success in working with people, consumers that we see, or organizations that we work with. But sometimes that we groan, we have to cry out. And that we groan says, like the psalmist, he repeatedly says, I cried out to the Lord, how long, O Lord? So you have to think, we're coming with creation groans, we groans, and then there are the Spirit groans. And the Spirit is sometimes we just don't know what to do about community. We don't know how to work successfully with community because community has a life of itself. And sometimes we're not connected to that community. And when we reach the end of words, that's when the Spirit groans. And that's when the Spirit comes and takes over in terms of what we do. And if we know not how to pray, we just need to listen. So as a part of a prayer group, we did a meditative prayer last night, and we sat in silence for almost 45 minutes with no words spoken. I didn't fall asleep. But just listening to what's going around us. And that's the Spirit that groans for us, that sometimes we don't understand how to deal with empowering diverse communities. Here I write that empowerment has had a constant theme with social work profession for over a century. In the late 1800s, conditions such as a concentration of wealth, large-scale immigration, and social economic recession contributed to great social needs that existing charitable institutions could not meet. Does that sound like 2009 to you? Very interesting. 1800s. Wow. So today, the social work profession faces similar economic conditions. Income differentials have become more pronounced, and the proportion of the middle class has shrunk. Does that sound like 2009? Very much so. I commend you for thinking of this topic because it really has relevance. If you look at what it's saying there, it has relevance and meaning for the times that we live in right now. We have diminishing resources. There's increased intergroup conflict. Empowerment provides one way for us to rethink about how we practice social work or social work practice. And that's kind of what I want to do this evening. As we look at empowerment, it's really looking at a person's access to control or over needed resources. What do they have at their disposal? Are they able to have some of that? How do they make decisions? How do they move about in solving their problems with community? And how do they mobilize to interact with others, to pursue changes, and to procure resources? There are some principles that I've learned along the way and try to work with them, is that the environment is a very important thing, as we all know as social workers. As we look at our ecosystem and our environment, that really is the thing that drives us. But we have to understand the whole person in their context. Doman Lum, who is a professor of social work at California State University, says this about understanding the whole person in context. Just listen carefully to what he says. The social context of those who suffer mental illness and oppression describes the essential elements of the individual and his or her particular environment. In order to fully understand a person, or I'll put it in this sense, a community, we must take into account the total context of how the texture of the person has been woven together to form a unique being. What pieces or ingredients have put together to form a mosaic or detailed pattern? So how has that community come to be? What's the total context that transcends the person and that environment, says Lohmann. But there's also a process that's involved as people try to become empowered. Is we have to change our attitudes. We have to worry about how I project myself to community. And I have to validate the experiences that people have in those communities. And I have to increase my knowledge so I can work better at helping these individuals. Jesus said in Matthew 9:38, and I'll just quote NRSV, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few." 2,000 years later, this still holds true. The task of empowering individuals and empowering communities is an enormous task, too large for any one group to accomplish. In fact, the challenge before us is much greater than it's ever been. To put this into a broader perspective, think with me as I go through these numbers here, and I won't read them, but you can look at them and you can read them. The world's population has doubled between 1960 and 2000. Between 1980 and 2000 marked an increase in minority population as compared to the white population. There was a doubling in the minority population, which increased by 41.3 million. Whereas in the white population, in that same period, only 13.7 million. More of the global population lives in poverty. So I'm not saying anything new here that perhaps you don't know. They have fewer opportunities for literacy development, perhaps more experiences with violence, a greater insecurity than ever before. The population in the U.S. is changing dramatically, as you see that there. By the year 2050, the Latino population will have grown to almost 25% in population. For minority populations, access to mental health services is worsening. 1 in 20 will make it to a mental health center. That's immigrants. 1 in 10 of U.S.-born Latinos will visit a mental health center or be with a counselor. Medicaid-insured black consumers are less likely to be treated for mood disorders than their white counterparts. Hispanics and blacks receive minimally adequate treatment for mood, anxiety, and impulse control disorders. While the quality of health care, we might say, is improving, well, we don't have health care reform, but it's improving for some people. We can have a debate on that some other time. It's really getting worse for Hispanics, especially if they speak little or no English. How do you feel? It's tough. Empowering diverse communities, bridging the social divide, is hard work. But you are to be commended because you're thinking about that community. And so I'll share a little bit more. That's compelling data. It makes the case for being more culturally competent in what we do in our strategies. Now let's talk about the empowerment map. And so hopefully we'll understand this. What I mean by an empowerment map, and I'll shortly invite my colleague Carmen in a little bit to come up. How many of you used a GPS to get here today? Okay. Yeah. Okay. When's the last time you used a road atlas? Use it every day. Very good. We got some faithful. Yeah, they need to keep publishing it then. It works. Okay. I used a GPS today, sure. My wife says I have a phobia because everywhere I go, I get lost. And so I'm calling somebody and asking, "Wait, ¿cómo llego allá? How do I get there?" Somebody says, "You just go that way." No, that's not the right thing. And so I even told the people that are my friends, I gave them the wrong directions. I told them to go to Hilton Inn, but the Hilton Inn is like the other side of town, on the other side of Market, right? Yeah. So I see Felipe walking. He's like, "Hey man, what's up? You know, it's just the wrong. It's the other hotel. Sorry man, I didn't have my GPS with me." Belkis was over there at the other Hilton too, and so probably would not have been a good idea to move everybody over there. But I like to think of maps as these things that guide us and give us purpose to getting to where we go. And so they serve as a guide to understand how to get from one place to another. I work in a really diverse place. It's open. I have no walls. I work with an environmental engineer who does water planning for the city of Chicago and other states. So this guy spends his whole time looking at maps. He is glued to the screen looking at maps. And the map tells him what needs to happen. And so he does water planning. And I'll talk more about him later. I also work with an executive coach. How many of you ever been to an executive coach? Very good. What'd you learn? Oh, man. I was hoping some profound stuff here. You know, a lot. Okay, I'm sure you're here. So he followed his goal to be a social worker, and he's here. Okay. This guy, he goes to organizations, and he hangs out with them, and they talk about strategic planning, and they talk about life goals and where you want to be in 5 years and where you want to be in 10 years. No, he sits right across from me, so I hear his phone calls and I'm taking notes. You know, I'm learning all this stuff, free stuff for me, you know, so I'm good to go, right? I work with an intercultural consultant. He helps communities think about intercultural relations and how people who are for gay rights and people who are against gay rights. So he sits with these two groups, and they try to figure it out, and they don't. Because they were trying to pass an ordinance or change something with non-discrimination in our town, and we had about 300 people show up at city. They had to take the meeting, city council. How many have been to a city council meeting? Very good. Well, they had to move it out of the city council building because there was 300 people. So they took it to the high school. They spent 6 hours back and forth, back and forth. My friend was there. He was living it, man. It was great. He was having a wonderful time. So he spends time with those groups. The other group that I work with are called Elkhart County Works Together, and I'll talk about them later. They are people who are unemployed. How many of you are unemployed in this room? Okay, Jay, all right, we'll get you a job. There's a young man here that could use a job. They're unemployed and they're underemployed. And they have come together to create an organization. these people are on fire, and I won't talk about them yet because I want to leave it for when it's their time. Eric does this all day. You see that? What does it look like? A map. And if you were really close, which I won't invite you to come to the screen, there are little dots. Can you see a few little dots there? Different colors?
Okay.
You see dots there, right? Ah, that's my map. This is Eric's map. Very technical, and he figures it out. This is my map. It took me a while to make those little circles. The copy and the paste, copy, paste, copy, paste.
That's forever.
Okay. Eric shared with me, I asked him, Eric, so when you look at a map, what are you looking at? What's going on with you in maps all day? And he says, well, you know, when I look at a map, I take into account various things. He gave me a whole list of things that I just didn't have time to write. But what I found most interesting is that his work with maps really involves looking to the future. So he spends all of his day thinking about the future. Wow. How many of us do that? How many of us spend time thinking about the future? Let's raise our hands. Wow. Pretty impressive. I need to join NACSW. Be more like you. He spends a lot of time figuring out where water should flow. So he spends his day thinking, where's the best place for water to flow in Chicago? Does anybody have an idea how much water is in a typical day is used in Chicago? How many gallons of water? Somebody take a guess. This is audio participation here. Oh, 500 billion. Okay, you're a little high. 10 billion gallons in Chicago alone on an average day. He looks at where the water should go in the next 10 to 15 years. He goes on to say that he tries to find where the stress points are in community, where the tension is going to be in the pipelines, how long do we think that water plants will function properly? What will happen to water pressure if there are too many people in the geographic area? You're probably wondering, why am I talking about water and planning? But if you listen carefully to Eric and what he does, it's really about vision planning. It's trying to understand what the future will look like with many peoples living in an identified geographical location. So the questions that come to my mind as we think about this map are, who's going to live in that community there? What kind of relationships are they going to have? Who are they going to engage with? What types of conflicts are they going to have? What types of intergroup situations will they have? What kinds of things will block constructive change for them? So as you think about empowering a diverse community and bridging that social divide, we have to ask ourselves those questions. What's blocking that constructive change? So we need an empowerment map. And this is what I'm thinking about as an empowerment map. The things that are important for us to be thinking about as social workers, as Christian social workers, is we need to be sure about virtues, which is being. Yesterday I sat for 45 minutes in silence and I was just being. I wasn't necessarily, as you look at the next one, vocation. I wasn't doing. I was being. And I was thinking about what I needed to do, but also realizing that we need to also spend time being. And those three things come to mind. I look at these things in terms of virtues in three ways. Virtues as personal, virtues as a gift, and virtues as communal. In the sense of personal, in terms of our virtues, we all have strengths. We all have things that are important to us and that we do well. And these are experiences that have shaped us, and it's the same way for communities right now. The gift that we have right now as social workers is that we can tell our virtues to other people, and that takes courage. In order to share what we know and to share what we are doing, it takes courage to tell other people. Communal is that it takes a risk to share what's really inside me. And the goodness that I have is always there with a community of people. So a strong Anabaptist thought is the community is the one that's really working together. And in terms of the virtues that we have, that's the important thing. I'm going to invite now my colleague, my friend, Carmen DeRusha. Carmen works for Purdue Extension, and she does community economic and community development. And she will tell you more about what she does in terms of empowerment. Carmen is from Colombia. Come on up. Carmen is from Colombia and just returned maybe like a week ago or 3 days. She was down there doing some teaching, and she will be telling a lot of her stories soon. So, Carmen, welcome, and tell us about what you do about empowering diverse communities.
Good evening. Thank you, Gilberto. It is, of course, my privilege to be one of Gilberto's friends, and I am very glad to be here tonight with you to share a little bit about what I think about empowerment. And before I do that, I will tell you some of my experiences and the time I have spent here in Indianapolis. I've been working in Indianapolis for 19 years, and prior to that, I lived for 5 years in Connecticut, and prior to that, I lived in Colombia almost half of my life. Well, I probably shouldn't say that. Now you know how old I am. It always happens to me. But it's more or less. So in my 19 years working here in Indianapolis, I have done several kinds of activities. But one of the activities that I have done is working with communities. And I did community organizing. I work with neighborhoods. I have taught leadership to groups, grassroots groups. I have worked with immigrants. I have worked in all sorts of roles, but always with one goal in mind. And the goal in mind is how can we help people who are not at the same level of privilege that a lot of us are. And in doing that, of course, every time that we work, we wonder, why is it that the work I do doesn't work as well as I really want? And many times, not only me, but a lot of my colleagues, we walk out of a work saying, really, these people don't want to be helped. And we feel so frustrated. And so I learned that we know more than we really think we know, but it takes time to get that knowledge out from inside. So I began kind of reflecting about it. What's the problem? What's going on here? And talking with other colleagues. And so finally, in a way, we learn, and some of the things I have learned in 19 years are some of the things that I would like to share with you tonight in terms of what is it that we need to do to empower and what is empowering to me. So to those many years of frustration at not knowing the magic recipe, I am getting close to it, to finding what are the things that work. And one of the things that work for me is when I think about empowering, I define empowering as the process of enabling people in diverse communities to identify, exercise, and use power wisely. Because sometimes we empower, you know, we have power, but it is important to put that last word wisely. So this definition for me is important because power, I think, is something that we all need to make things happen in our communities. And power provides influence, but also influence provides power. So out of those things. So how can you acquire power and how can you gain influence and how do you do that? So in my work in the community development area and specifically working with disempowered communities, I have learned that my role is to create an environment where disempowered individuals can begin to identify ways to gain power and influence. And in my practice, I found that the exercise of several skills helped the creation of those environments. So certainly, I don't feel that I am God that gives power, of course not. But the only thing I could do is to create those environments where people can begin feeling, identifying, testing, smelling, practicing, experiencing how that power can begin. So I, in my magic recipe of empowerment, I think when I come to a community, all of us went to school, have master's degrees, social work, psychology, all those kinds of things. So we feel empowered. We think we know what people need. So we come into communities ready to tell them what is it that I need and how to get. And what I discover is that in no way what I know is equally important to what they know about themselves and about their communities. So I learned to listen. And again, I remember, you know, why God give us two ears and one mouth. So that's the reason. We need to listen double the time that we need to listen double that we talk. So I learned to listen a lot. I learned humility because what I know, as I said, is not equally as important as what the people I want to help know. And the most important, I have to learn about what their needs are. Sometimes we go into communities to help people and we think we know what they need. Let me tell you, we really don't know. And every time you come out and saying those people don't want to be helped, it's because you really don't have what they need. And it's not about them, it's not their problem, but it's most of the time our problem. I also believe that in that magic recipe, we need to have a very respectful partnership. It is not a paternalistic relationship, it's a partnership. We need each other. And sometimes we need them more than they need us, because at least we get paid for it. Isn't it? That's our job. We get paid for it. And they do not. So we ask a lot from the people we want to help. So we need to develop a very respectful partnership. I also believe that in that relationship, we need to be less controlling and more of a friend, more of a coach, rather than the control. Most people in this empowered positions, they are there not because they want or they chose to be there. It's because we do have some social structure inequalities in our society that maintain some people in places where they didn't have a choice. And so we need to go there with that respect and that understanding. I also think that we need to work very hard on unleashing the energy and intelligence of people. And beginning with, we need to realize that they do have intelligence and they do have energy. And I will tell you many, many anecdotes about the times that I encountered that after thinking that I was giving them, you know, the knowledge that I have to tell them what to do, I have again to gain humility because they knew more than I did. So by the end, I kind of had given myself the title of facilitator. I am no longer a teacher. I am no longer an expert. I am no longer any of those things. I am a facilitator. But what is it that I facilitate? I do facilitate the creation of environments where people can begin gaining the power that they have lost because they thought that they were in the place where they were, disadvantaged position, just because they were less than somebody else. And certainly I was not going to go there and tell them that I was better than they were. So those are kinds of things that I wanted to share about my recipe and the recipe that I have been building for the last 19 years. But I also have some practical solutions, and I am going to go through the list very quickly because I have 5 minutes. And some of the things that I want to say, practical suggestions, if you want kind of that recipe to check out things, I would like to recommend that every time you go into a disempowered community, try to promote the people inside that community, and you will see what happens. Promoting meaning that as you, as I, we are in privileged positions, we need to give the hand to people to get them out to access those opportunities that we have had and they have not. That's what I mean by promoting people. Sometimes in our work, we find people that don't have the same skills, but they come from diverse communities. Rather than to judge them, I think that we own to them to coach them and help them out, acquire the skills that they need to do a better job, rather than to go immediately into the judgment and the evaluation. I think that we need to be a role model. I think that we need to be respectful, and we need to be a role model of surrounding ourselves with diverse people. And talking about diversity, I had a friend that I was, you know, making myself this really cool person that has a lot of friends from the diverse backgrounds and diverse races and all that. And so one of my African-American friends asked me, how many times have you invited a person that is very different from you for a dinner to your house? How many of us really have acquaintances, but how many times have we really asked somebody who is different than us over for dinner as an equal, as to get to know? So I'm glad, you know, me too, but it took me a long time to get to that place and making sure that it wasn't not only a professional or superficial relationship. The other part that I invite you to do is that we need to mentor people. Research shows that we mentor people that look like us. So that's why we keep replicating the same opportunities for people that look like us. So challenge yourself to mentor someone who is very different and comes from a disadvantaged background. And the other, I will say, that is to interact and develop meaningful relationships with people and other members of diverse communities. And the invitation, you know this, be aware and sensitive and respectful of all of those very little details that make us form our own diverse cultures. And also be aware that resistance is a real phenomenon when we are inviting others to do different things, or we are exposing ourselves to do different things. There are many ways that we resist to change. There are many ways that we resist to do things that are not part of the norm. So those are the thoughts that I have for tonight. And it's been a pleasure to be here. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Carmen. I want to invite next my friends who are from Latino Youth Collective, and they will share with you briefly. I have several slides that we need to get through, but I'm going to move rather quickly. I know we have an activity. I think you have an activity after this, but I want to allow Felipe and Jair to share with you their presentation.
We can just skip. All right. As what usually happens with us in technology, and usually most people, as a university professor, I know that most people use PowerPoint as crutches because, you know, they're putting the information together at the last minute. They don't necessarily know it. And so I know what I'm talking about, so we don't need that right now. I'm always really scared to talk to people, particularly about issues with what we call Latinos. And I'm usually scared because most people lie to us. And as a teacher, I know that mostly we lie to our students. And it's not because we want to. It's because, for instance, I was a social studies teacher before I went on to the university. And it just so happens that the particular standards that we try to hit with our curriculums, a lot of them aren't just a little misleading, they're completely wrong, particularly when we're talking about Native Americans and a lot of that history. So I'm telling you this because as I was sitting there, I was thinking, when was the last time I was able to come and talk about God? And I say this because 20 years ago, I was standing in front of a room like this, and I was kind of sunk in the water. My mother had taken us to a Pentecostal church. And it was the 20 years ago today, actually the 29th, was when I decided as a 12-year-old kid to accept Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. And thank you. And it's been a very hard path, and I've definitely progressed, and you know, got through college and those years of doubt. But it warms my heart that I'm able to share with you today some of the things I'm going to share with you in regards to what we do with the Latino Youth Collective of Indiana. I like Gilberto, I'm not from Indiana. I'm a migrant. My parents were migrant farm workers. I'm actually a migrant student. They went to migrate with the crops. I went to migrate with land-grant universities that provided opportunities for Latinos. Because there's a lot of us in Texas wanting to go to college, and for some reason, a lot of Latinos aren't busting through the doors in Indiana, although that's something we're here to change. And a lot of emerging Latino communities throughout the country are feeling these same kinds of tensions and stresses. And so I wanted to just tell y'all one story today. And oftentimes when I'm in schools, I get in trouble for telling the story. But today I think it's going to be okay. And it has to do with this idea of Indian. And although I work with Latino youth, as an ethnographer, I work with peoples from all over the world. And in particular, I work with gang members. And that's the kind of work that I do that involves the underground economy. So I'm going to just do one activity that I do with all of my students. So if you could raise your hand, and you know, no, you're not throwing a gang sign. I just want you to put your hand up, throw a little circle, look through it if you can, all right? And I know it's really late, y'all are probably tired, but I'm going to try to trick y'all a little bit. I want you to grab that circle, and I want you to put it on your chin. Some of y'all are laughing, right? Why? Why? Some of y'all are like, it's right here, it's right here. What did I say? Put it where? Chin. Some people are still like, why are people laughing at me? All right. Now, I do that because as a teacher, there were certain things that I knew and ways that I learned that my teachers didn't get. And nowadays, when I work with youth, the same thing all over again. They grow up, and companies and countries and organizations spend billions of dollars researching how it is that we can engineer the thinking of human beings all over the world. And we do this through the media and consumer. But the point is that our youth, our kids, and people my generation, they don't always do what they hear. They do, like, over three quarters of the people in this room. And so what is that? And for me, it was always interesting because as a kid growing up, you wonder why kids do what they do, why human beings do what they do. Well, they see it. They experience it. And so a lot of the work of social workers that I've worked with and that I love has to do with this idea of healing. And so the Latino Youth Collective, first and foremost, finds resources and opportunities to invest in youth so that they can do things like personal and community development. And we use different methods. Carmen de Rucha is on our board of the Latino Youth Collective. And through a lot of her efforts and her generations of people have created methods like critical pedagogy and participatory action research. And all of these ways that we can go about doing this work that we're talking about in a more rigorous way, like they say. So the story I was going to tell y'all is about Indian, because they always tell me I'm an Indian when I go into schools, and I am. And when I tell you that I was born again 20 years ago today, and I tell you that as an Indian I don't have a religion, I usually make people upset, because as Indians we don't have a religion, and I'll tell you why. And if you look at the etymology of the word religion, you know it's to reconnect. And as Indians, we don't disconnect. Hence why we even use the word Indian. So in schools, we usually tell little kids, the word Indian came about because Columbus thought he was sailing to India, but instead he kind of got his GPS confused. He ended up, and everybody claims as the first person that received Columbus. Like El Salvadorans will tell you they claim him, and Dominicans will tell you they claim. Everybody wants to claim him first. But what we're not always told is that he was an Italian guy, and he was writing home in Spanish. You mess things up when you write in another language sometimes. And so he was journaling back, and he says, Encontré una gente en Dios. I found a people in God. He didn't say I got lost going to India. He said I found a godly people. And I know this because one of our ships sank. And they cried for hours, 4 hours, wept in solidarity for us. I've never met a more godly people. Encontré una gente en Dios. So when we talk about Latinos, it's not that we don't have a religion. Yes, Pentecostals, Christians, everyone else that has kind of institutionalized a way of healing, a way of seeking a spiritual answer to life, whether it came from Europe or Asia, we've all asked similar questions all over the world. But this idea of encontré una gente en Dios is very, very different now that we think about Latinos. It wasn't just somebody's GPS got taken out. Now, suddenly, there's not a deficit way of understanding these people. They're a spiritual people. So if you take that inquiry and you go down that path and you say, well, when they come into the United States as health workers, mental health workers, we know that they are the healthiest people across the social gradient. When you look at the social determinants of health in Latino immigrants, they are the healthiest people in our society, regardless of income, regardless of education, regardless of geography of where you live. But after 5 years, that changes significantly. There's something about this society, these institutions. And when Gilberto asks you, and I beg you, to not look at things individually, he's also saying that we don't have to be classist, sexist, racist, homophobic as individuals to participate in systems that are that way. And so as a Latino Youth Collective in our work, it begins with everyday communication, just like that little exercise I just did. How is it that kids are being socialized to be human beings? Why is it that they think of themselves of these terms like black and brown and white? What's destructive about these ways to label ourselves and name ourselves? Because if we take that line of thought of being Indian, being that we're a people in God, we know that they're, all of their creation stories saying that we're one heart, one mind. And that, like we know in chaos theory and quantum mechanics in the world, everything is spinning all the time. And we're all one, one heart, one mind always. And we're all made up of all the elements of the universe. So Indian mythology and philosophy tells us, well, we have these four elements. What are they? Fire, water, earth, wind. Wind. And each of those has a sacred color and a sacred power. So for the Latino Youth Collective, one heart, one mind. And we know that human beings all over the world have shades of yellow, red, black, and white. All shit, but it's all one humanity, one heart, one mind with different powers. So we know that God, the idea of the creator, the great mystery, reveals herself or himself to us in four ways by learning through the physical, the mental, the spiritual, and the emotional. Most of our schools and institutions in the United States hardly ever focus on the emotional or the spiritual. If anything, we do a little PE, but there's not much of the physical. So most of it is just the mental, which is what AYP and standardized tests and No Child Left Behind is all about. But as human beings on Earth, there's something more than just creating a more economic, sustainable world. It's about creating this one heart, one mind, where we love each other regardless of what we look like, regardless of which way we learn, whether it's through music or artistically, or whether it's because we're writing and reading numbers. So the work of the Latino Youth Collective throughout the state has been, like Carmen said, what is this secret recipe? For us has been, how do we heal as a community? And what is it about Latino immigrants that teach us the way about spirituality? For us has been this idea of family, the healing power of family. A lot of people call it collective consciousness. Other people just experience it through church. So for us as Latinos in Indiana and new emerging Latino communities, as you know, all over the country, there's a lot of tension going on right now. There's a lot of violence. There's things coming out of people that I love that I never even knew that they harbored because of these immigration issues and these economic issues. So as a community, what's our response? Because our number one responsibility is to respond. And so for us, it's about healing first. If our kids can't heal with the emotional trauma that they deal with every day, How can they ever be empowered? How can they ever make those decisions? So I invite you all to go to our website, latinoyouthcollectives.com. We're able to share our resources and our program activities with you all. Thank you very much.
This is why I invited them to come.
I'm going to put you back up, I promise.
I know you will. And we'll be done shortly. I want to invite now Belkis Ramirez, who works for Latino Health Organization. Diverse communities means that what I've been hearing from my friends is listening just to different stories. And Belkis will share a short story of the work that she's doing with a program that we've developed in Northeast Indiana. And then I'll wrap it up with some last thoughts and go from there.
Hello, everyone, and thank you very much for having me tonight. I'm still learning English, so it's not really perfect. I work for the Latino Health Organization. I am the Tobacco Prevention Coordinator. I work as an outreach for the people, and I try to educate the kids and their parents to avoid the use of the tobacco and secondhand smoke. And thank you very much, Gilberto, for having me tonight, inviting me. And thank you very much for training in the Bienvenidos program. This Bienvenido program is a very helpful program because help people to get a better mental health. Because when people from another countries came to the United States, they start a new life in a new country with a new future. And they start a roller coaster with ups and downs, ups and downs. And the Bienvenido programs, that means welcome programs, help people to start, okay, you have ups, but when you get down, don't get too deep. We can help you. There is so many things to do out there, so many people who are there waiting for help. And during this program, Bienvenidos program, people share their different experiences, met other people, know about the different services, and they know about the different culture in the United States. About my life, I am married. I got twins. They are boys. And I know it's difficult for them. Had a culture, Latin culture in my home, and then go to the kindergarten and get another culture totally different. So I know in their little minds it's kind of confused, two different like words in the same city. So it's very confused. And with this program, I'm learning that I can show my kids my culture. I'm from Colombia, that is in South America. I can teach them so many things about my parents, about my roof. But I also want my kids know about the beautiful country, the United States, know about the beautiful culture, the beautiful people, this language that I'm still learning. And get the intercultural in this new world. And in the Latino Health Organization, we're working with the Prosecure Office. We're also working with people in probation and with the different churches. And we are also doing the program for adult and young people. And we are doing this because with the Bienvenidos program, we are trying to help people to get a healthy mental health and try to help them in order to, I'm sorry, I'm very nervous. It's the first time I'm in front of so many people. thank you very much. And we are trying to help people because if the Latin immigrant people have a good, very healthy, they are going to get a good life in the United States. Okay, I'm really nervous. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Belkis. What my friends have shared, Belkis and Felipe and Carmen, is a vision that we have that we've been working in Northeastern Center with our Bienvenido program, and that's a strength-based program which brings people together to look at their goals and clarify their goals. But also, an interesting thing that Felipe was talking about is this whole notion of the spiritual. And so we're finding that people are coming together, and it becomes a spiritual experience where they're finding time to pray and time to meditate and work with each other. As Belki said, these are the things that we're working at within our program. And you can go to our website at www.nec.org to look at more at the Bienvenido program. And really encouraging people to cultivate relationships. Out of all of those, I think that's the most important one, where people are not so separated anymore, but they can work together and feel like they're a part of a community. Some of the things we work with in community is going to different factories and working with people at their site there to think about skill development. So these are some folks that we've worked with. We also have an empowered community where we've trained individuals in our community to actually become facilitators. And so Belkis is a facilitator for us or for her organization, where she now takes the curriculum and works at developing an empowering community. And we meet bi-monthly as facilitators and ourselves, and to do different activities. Another group that I'll just mention briefly is the Burmese Mental Health Task Force. Does anybody know where the largest population of Burmese outside of Burma is in? It's in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, we have an interesting phenomenon going on. Many people are coming as refugees and being settled in Fort Wayne. And the fascinating thing is that the community is coming together to work on identifying what the mental health needs are. So being part of a mental health task force to understand what those needs are, and then have the own Burmese people create the mental health needs assessment, working with IU School of Medicine to identify the proper protocols, etc. But understanding what it is that they need. And so we'll meet next week, to better understand what those needs are. This group is out of Paraguay that I have been working with here the last 6 months. I had the opportunity to meet them while I was at Mennonite World Conference. They have trained 2,000 youth within the last 2 years. 2,000 youth to become leaders of their community. They are on fire. These people are developing software. These people are preparing the next generation. I just got an email from him today that they finished another curriculum, and so we're in partnership to perhaps bring that curriculum here to the United States. They are doing phenomenal work in terms of empowering that diverse community. Some final thoughts in terms of how do we know empowerment is happening? How do we know that God's Spirit is moving among us? We have to ask ourselves some fundamental questions. And I think those questions are, who sets the vision in that community? Is it you, the social worker? Is it the community that's setting the vision? Or is it God's vision? Is God helping the community to develop a vision for what should happen in the community? And the fundamental question is, what's our direction? What's our purpose? So the question for NASW is, what's your purpose? What's your direction with empowering diverse communities? And so it's taking these stories that you've heard and go back to your communities and ask yourself, what's the vision that I want for diverse communities and empowered communities? And I think creating that vision is this. It's working together. The vision is not of individuals, but it's of many. Very interesting that the people that are working in Paraguay and Paraguay are using the very same words that we have been using here. Vision, doing, and being. Hacer, saber, y ser. I sat in their workshop in Paraguay. I had no idea who they were. I sat, and they are using the same terminology that we are. Being, doing, and knowing. Hacer, saber, y ser. God's Spirit moves in many places, and we have many visions, but the vision is that we come together. So they have such a powerful vision in South America. could that vision become reality in North America in terms of what they're doing in South America? I think so. It's doing some substance and substantive listening, what Carmen was saying. We do too much talking. And so last night for me to spend 45 minutes in silence was powerful. I was able to get in tune with my spirit to understand what God has for me in my life, in my family, etc. And Carmen again talked about partnerships. It's if we don't take those steps of faith to partner with people who are different from us. So I have a relationship with a friend of mine who is Buddhist. And we meet once a month to talk about salvation and understanding what salvation means to a Buddhist or Nirvana or however you want to call it. But we're working on a book that's called What Christians Can Learn from Buddhism. It's sitting down with someone who is different from us as we relate to individuals who we are good friends. And I believe that Jesus Christ is my personal Lord and Savior. And he believes differently. But that does not mean that we cannot sit and have an interreligious dialogue. I come to my relationship with him knowing whom I serve. I do not come in fear. I do not come in doubt. I do not come to change and to be changed. I go to that relationship to be a witness and to teach and to model and to be Christ-like, just as he comes to our relationship with some of the same things. So it's listening to people and it's learning to trust that spirit that groans. These are my final thoughts. Do you all remember the words that were on here before the face of Christ? Can you name them? Hungry, pain, forgotten. Yeah. It's our task as Christian social workers to listen to the marginalized. We must stop to listen to the people who have not. We have to bridge the social divide. We have to make peace on earth. I don't want to sound so fluffy, but we have to live a life of disinterest. Chris Marshall, an Anabaptist theologian from New Zealand, says, "Leading a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called means, above all, being committed to reconciliation and peacemaking." Marshall adds three things. First, we must know our calling. This is what we mean by vision. If we help community understand their vision, the work doesn't become easier. It just becomes clearer. Marshall says that knowing our calling is to participate in God's great work of healing the universe through Jesus Christ. Marshall believes that we must cultivate those qualities of Christian character that give expression to our calling. This is what we mean by virtues. If we understand our virtues and our strengths as we work with diverse communities, we will show our true self, which is the face of Christ. And it's right there. If we have the virtue of humility, of patience, of gentleness and forbearance, we live out these virtues in communities that have conflict. As Felipe said, we will have healing. If we're clear about what the church's role is and our role as Christian social workers, then we will complement that biblical mission in Matthew 25. Perhaps others who have come before us have not done such a great job of empowering people, but that does not mean that we have to settle for less. This will be that we have to confront those injustices, those racial prejudices and hurt feelings in communities. As social workers, we must acknowledge the situations that exist and we must name them and be conscientious of those who are hurt. To empower diverse communities will mean having conversations with those who differ from us, and the niceness of empowering a diverse community may not be staple. There's nothing romantic about what you have talked about as your mission of empowering diverse communities. We must ask ourselves, are we called to do this? Is this our vocation? Is this our calling? I think you have said yes, because you're here today. Empowering communities will require us, as social workers, to live through the divisions in our community. Danisa Novu from Zimbabwe says, challenge us to walk together, emulate as Christ did here on earth, so that our own witness will be questioned. He presses on when he says, we sing a similar song, but many times we seek to promote ourselves, thus we lose our way. Very interesting. Felipe talked about the four. And it's interesting, this is also three V's. Vision, virtues, and vocation. We need to hold them close to our heart if we were to work with people in community. So it's been learning new games, playing new things in community, learning new things. And as social workers, finally, we're called to walk among a diverse community, to live in a right relationship with this community, and let God's Spirit participate in the empowerment of diverse communities. We must trust the Spirit to participate in this work around us and through us. We must identify the virtues. We must identify the vocation. We must identify that work of people and community. How do you bridge that social divide? We bridge that social divide through the support, encouragement, counsel, and companionship of friends who pursue the quest of empowerment with us. That's how we do it. That's how I do it with these people. And I'm learning, and we're going forth. Thank you for this time to share with you. May God's blessings be upon you as you continue to work in your communities. I had a song to sing, but I know we're really late, so I'm going to pass on that, and we'll sing it for you at the next conference.